Good morning. I'm Patty Kostelic. The conversation I am about to play for you today was recorded in late January when a statewide conference for early childhood educators, which was sponsored by the Fairbanks Association for Young Children and TVCC, was held on the UAF campus. As this week has been declared National Week of the Young Child, I thought that this would be an appropriate time for me to play this tape for you. In addition to a couple of conferences for families that are being held in Anchorage, we have visiting with us in Fairbanks this upcoming week Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. He is being hailed as the new Dr. Spock, and he will be speaking on the UAF campus in the Charles W. Davis Concert Hall for free on April 17th at 8 p.m. sponsored by the UAF Special Events Committee. So I encourage all of you who are interested in early childhood development to come here, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. So without further ado, let's go to the Home Fires radio show featuring Dr. Bernard Spodek, Lillian Sugarman, and Diane Siskind. Good morning and welcome to Home Fires radio show. With me in the studio this morning are some visiting experts whose specialty is early childhood education. I have with me Dr. Bernard Spodek, who's a professor of early childhood education at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. Lillian Sugarman, who's from Washington, D.C., and she's the representative for Child Development Associates. And Dr. Diane Siskind, who's our local expert, who is doing consulting work in early childhood education, and who is the recent prime organizer of the conference that we had at the University of Alaska on, what were the dates?
January 26th to the 25th, 26th.
25th and 26th. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, I would like for the benefit of the audience to talk a little bit about your backgrounds, and I think it's probably better for you to introduce yourselves than it is for me. It's unusual for a man to be involved so intensely with early childhood education. Is that not true?
It's probably true that men represent the minority in the field of early childhood education.
How did you choose that?
Well, almost by accident, to be very honest. I started teaching in nursery school back in 1952, so I've been in the field about 33 years now, and really got interested in it as a result of a child development course that I had as an undergraduate at the Brooklyn College, and found myself being offered a job and taking it, and in the process wanting to find out what I was supposed to do once I got the job, so I began to take courses in early childhood education.
So you started
and just stayed in the field.
So you started out as an education major?
I started out as a psychology major. Had I been an education major, they would have told me that men don't belong in early childhood education. As a psychology major,
uh-huh.
I didn't know that.
Right. Right. As a psychology major, you're
very
interested
right.
in early development.
Yeah, but I've done all of my graduate work in early childhood education, and I've taught nursery school, kindergarten, five-year-olds, primary grades, and I've been a university professor, first at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee for 4 years, and finishing up 20 years now at the University of Illinois.
My alma mater.
Great.
And also Diane's.
Yeah.
For the benefit of our audience, some of the people in town know about your background, but before we get to Lillian, why don't you tell us about...
Well, I met Dr. Spodek in, what, it's almost 20 years? No, it couldn't be 20
no.
years.
It's only
10
not
years.
That old, yeah.
And I got my doctorate at the University of Illinois through his persuasion.
And you were always going to be a teacher? Was that an aspiration of yours from your high school days?
Mm-hmm.
And always early childhood? Or
yeah.
Tell them where you were at the time.
Oh, yeah. I was in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and Queenie Mills, who was at Illinois, came over, and she got me to start writing to him because I had a nursery school, and because there was a need in the community, and they were all different nationalities, and it was really difficult. I never taught a nursery school that I couldn't speak the same language as any of the children.
What were you doing in Thailand? How did you get there? Oh, you went there to start nursery school?
No, after I got my master's from Syracuse, I decided to go around the world. So for 2 years I traveled and stayed in Chiang Mai and then went to Israel and worked on a kibbutz.
And that brings us to Lillian, who is from Washington, D.C.
Right.
And what is your background in early childhood education?
I've been in the field of early childhood education for about 20 years. I most recently got a master's in social work, and I have been involved both as a teacher and a director and a teacher trainer in the field of early childhood and special education. And I've been working with the Child Development Associate Project for the past 10 years, both as a representative who does assessments and now as the one who's responsible for training and supervising the consultant pool that we have, which we refer to as CDA reps.
So we have here in the studio some considerable experience with this field. Does the theory and practice of early childhood education change as often as our ideas on toilet training and bottle feeding versus breastfeeding and all the other prescriptive things that sort of cycle and recycle?
Well, to some extent, it cycles and recycles. It's a fairly young field as educational fields go. It probably goes back just about 100 years now, 150 years now, to Friedrich Froebel in Germany with the kindergartens. And that was the early childhood program started before there was a theory of child development. But what we see as early childhood education today probably had its roots in the child study movement and and in progressive education with John Dewey and G. Stanley Hall at the turn of the century. As theories evolved and developed, you always see some changes in practice. Probably in the 1920s, there was much more of an orientation in kindergartens towards a behavioral approach, teaching children proper habits, for example. The Freudians had a major influence on early childhood education in the 30s and 40s. In the last decade or two, probably a greater concern for intellectual development and the work of Jean Piaget having an impact. So from that point of view, theories have changed and have impacted on programs, but programs have also evolved importantly in terms of social needs. So that if you go back to the 30s, you had a great deal of unemployment. The nursery schools were established by the federal government to provide work relief for teachers who were fired from the public schools because they couldn't afford to support them. And so you found nursery schools starting as a response to a social need. In the 1940s, we had daycare to provide women workers for war industries, and the Lanham Act schools went there. In the 60s, we had the War on Poverty, and you begin to see Head Start programs, which were early childhood programs, as one way to fight poverty and eliminate poverty. And it didn't eliminate poverty, but it made a great impact on the lives of children today. As you began to see changes in the structure of families, higher and higher proportion of women going to work in the 70s and beyond, you saw a tremendous need for daycare and just an explosion in the number of daycare centers throughout the United States, something we still haven't come to grips with.
That's clear. I would like to go into some of this in a little more detail, but first I'd like to sort of add to this that even our concept of what constitutes childhood has really changed markedly in the last century, starting with the Industrial Revolution and the child labor laws. So things that seem sort of firm definitions to us and somehow sacrosanct, the importance of, for example, a child being home from the time that the child is born to 5 years old, and the fact that we have our kindergartens organized around an idea that the child needs to sort of get into the school routine gradually and only go a half a day the first year in school. We have a lot of children now who've been in daycare since they were three and full time.
Sure.
Six months sometimes.
And so, in fact, it's sort of going backwards to go into a kindergarten situation for half a day for kids that are used to being there all day.
That's right. And what you're seeing in the United States today is a real concern about what's happening in kindergartens and the suggestion in many places, New York State, for example, for all-day kindergartens. New York City provides all-day kindergartens for all the children in the schools. The public schools are really concerned about early childhood education, and because some of the evidence demonstrates that it makes a great deal of difference, especially for children at risk, handicapped children or children who lack the sort of experiences that increase the probability of their success in school, that they're moving more towards all-day kindergartens for four-year-olds as well as for five-year-olds. And there are some states today who are seriously considering the possibility of mandating compulsory school attendance from the age of five on.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of studies and impetus for Head Start. You correct me because I'm just a layperson and I don't have children, so I'm a real observer. Some of the work that was done at that time sort of supported the idea that children, by the time they were entering kindergarten, if they were from quote-unquote disadvantaged homes perhaps where they didn't get as much attention or as much access to stimulating materials, were at such an educational deficit at that early age that in some ways they never caught up.
And not only that, but a lot of the research on development suggested that because the rate of development is so much greater when children are younger, that any attempt to change that development would have a greater impact early on. So that if we could kind of reach these children before they went into school, we could literally give them a head start into the schools. And the research that was going on from 1960 to 1965 predated Head Start. And the research on Head Start programs that have been going since 1965 suggests that to a great extent these programs have been successful. Not necessarily successful, though, in the way they were originally conceived of. If you're around in 1965, we talked a lot about raising IQ. You know, we want to raise kids' IQ 10 points or 20 points. And you found, indeed, if you put a kid in a program early on, you could jack his IQ score up by about 10 or 12 points. But once he was in school for a couple of years, the difference didn't seem to hold up. But what we're finding now, we've had 20, 25 years of experience, and we've been able to collect some of the research on the kids that were in these early programs and follow them up through elementary school, through high school, and even beyond into early work life, you know, of a young adult. And you find, for example, that children who have been in these kinds of programs have greater success in school. The chance of their being referred to a special ed class, for example, is reduced. The chance of their being retained in grade, being left back, is reduced. The chance of their dropping out of school in high school is reduced. The girls seem to, there are fewer teenage pregnancies, the boys and girls have fewer run-ins with the law.
Okay, why do we speculate that is? Is that the result of higher esteem or actual knowledge that they gain at an earlier age?
Well, I think it's a lot of things, and you know, we're really speculating here about it. One is, I think kids sort of learn how to learn, so that even though you may not raise IQ, the children learn to make better use of their what intelligence they have. They also learn to value school and learn how to function well within the schools early on, so that the chance of success is higher. And I think it's a multiplier. If you do better, you feel better about yourself. The parents feel better about these kids as well. So that it provides a lot of stability and development that seems to be important as the kids grow up.
Well, this seems to refute the idea that really the best thing that children could be doing with those early years is to be home in the nurturing atmosphere of their family, which is not that I want to in any way imply that that's bad, but the fear on the part of many is that children going to school and being away from home too fast will really have some serious psychological repercussions later on.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of points I need to react to that.
Okay.
One is that not all home experiences are the same as all other home experiences, that there are some parents who spend a lot of time with the children and provide a supportive and nurturing environment, and the kids really learn a lot in all sorts of ways. There are parents who literally teach their kids to read, for example, though informally. There are other parents who spend less time, and the quality of time is less good. There are some children for whom the home is not a pleasant place to be. I mean, you know, you got the whole range. Similarly, you have a range in the quality of programs that are being offered to children. that some programs are good and some programs are less good. And just putting a child into a program, a child care program or nursery program, in and of itself isn't going to make a difference. There are certain quality elements that are important, and it's the absence or presence of these elements that really make a difference in terms of whether or not the program will be effective. And the most important of those, and Lily, you might want to comment on this, is the quality of the staff, the background, okay, preparation, training.
We'll get to that, but just to underline this point then, there isn't one perfect way for a child to spend those early developmental
years. And there isn't one perfect program for young children.
And there isn't one formula that we can say, if you do this, then everything will be fine.
No, and also, early childhood education isn't the magic bullet, so that, you know, if you give a kid a good early childhood program and then forget about him for the rest of his life, you know, he's not going to be protected by that kind of inoculation of early experience.
But also we need to lessen somehow the guilt that many women who are in the workforce,
sure,
by necessity feel,
sure,
about leaving their,
sure,
their children in daycare.
Sure.
There is a lot of that subtle pressure, stated and unstated. National Public Radio did a whole 5-part series, I think last fall, on daycare in our society. And one of the points that really struck very strongly to me was the lack of concrete knowledge that many women, even professional women, this was based on some interviews done in the Cambridge area around Harvard and lots of universities, even that many professional women had very poor knowledge of the actual hour-by-hour content of the daycare programs that their children were in. And this person, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who did the study, attributed this to what he felt was fairly deep-seated ambivalence on the part of the women about leaving their children in someone else's care at this early age, that their careers necessitated it, they were single parents, or just the fact that our society really penalizes you for taking 5 years out of a career, no matter what kind of career it is. And so for whatever reason, they are in the workforce and in the workforce to stay, and yet they really feel guilty about leaving their young children. And one of the ways of dealing with this is sort of to ignore the content of that time.
I think there are other explanations, one of which is if the parent is working at the same time, they don't have the time to visit. So what information they get is secondhand information. Often the parent's concerned is more with the safety of the child than with the quality of the experience. Also, that child care, you know, it's all often thought of almost as warehousing kids. You know, if we keep them safe, that no harm will come to them, then it's okay. And if you do that, then it isn't terribly important to know what kinds of experiences.
But that strikes me as fairly inconsistent with the idea that these first 5 years are developmentally,
sure,
perhaps the most significant of our lives, that we learn at a faster rate, that it sets the stage for all future learning.
Yeah. One of the problems you have in a society like ours where we leave parents and families alone is that very often you almost set up parents and child so that the interest of one is antagonistic to the interest of the other. That the parent has to choose whether, you know, to stay home or to send the child to a daycare center. And you have to look at, all of the things that are involved in it. Sometimes it's more important for a parent to find a center that's convenient and that's affordable, that because the money is coming, you know, the fees are coming out of their pocket, than to find the best possible center in a community. You know, that's what I mean of setting up the interests of one,
mm-hmm,
against the interests of the other. Just like if the teacher salaries are too high, then the fees that the parent must pay has to become too high also. So those interests are set up one against the other as well.
So very often the first question is, how much,
sure,
does this cost? The second question is, where are you located?
Sure.
The third question is, what are your hours?
Sure.
And fourth or fifth or sixth.
Are you licensed? Is it safe?
And then finally, what are you teaching my child,
sure,
during this very important formative,
right, if
time?
If you ever tried to drive around Boston, you'll find that where it's located may be very important.
Okay. I really, and I encourage any, and Lillian and Diane to join in on this, I just really, before we leave this point, I just want to establish that before we can talk about the quality of daycare and what constitutes good daycare, I think we really need to thoroughly address this problem. Do parents have the time to find out what it is? How can they find out?
Yeah. Also, do they have the competency? Do they know what to look for? You know, it's, you know, when you buy a car, you don't know what goes into the engine. You need expert advice. You need help to make judgments, right? Similarly, when you go into daycare, unless you're a professional, unless you've been trained, you don't necessarily know. You know, it's not self-evident what the indicators of high-quality daycare are. You need help. Sometimes communities can provide it through referral agencies. Licensing, state licensing, is supposed to provide only the barest minimum requirements so that the child will be safe. State licensing kind of is a way of attesting to the fact that a child placed in this context will not be harmed. Right? But licensing doesn't say this is a high-quality program. And right now there are very few ways in which parents can easily find out whether a program is a good one or not.
Is that your experience also?
It is. I think in some areas there are publications that list quality programs, but again, I think their standard of what is licensing, and I think that some local affiliates to the Association for the Education of Young Children have information and referral aspects of their program. But again, a family moving into an area is not particularly aware of that facility and doesn't know, you know, that they can contact that. I think with the sexual abuse getting so much attention recently in the news media, parents have been warned to go and visit centers, and if they do have the time, I think that would be the advice to give to parents to check out the facility, and while they may not have a checklist to evaluate a program, they could at least go and see firsthand whether or not it's a safe program and the quality of the interactions between the staff and the children.
Do you think most centers encourage parents to visit from time to time, to spend a few hours?
Oh, I think if they feel comfortable with themselves. There's four criteria that I know of that help directors with their centers. One, to look at, or parents can look at, the child, how many children does that child, does the child have to look at while in a day? And the smaller the amount, the higher the quality.
Okay. Does that mean if there are 40 children interacting with each other, the quality isn't as high as if there are 12?
Even if there's 40 in the center, as long as they're in a smaller group. That's one criteria. Another one is that, the ongoing supervision and...
The teacher-child ratio?
No, that the director, that the staff has ongoing supervision. Okay. That someone's saying, talk about what they're doing with the children. And then a third one is that they have training, and like the conference did training, and I hope it'll encourage discussion. And also the teacher-staff ratio. I mean, how many children are with the...
Right.
Yeah, some of the research that's been done in terms of quality daycare suggests that the cutoff for 3 and 4-year-olds is about one adult per 7 children. And that the size of the group should be no more than twice that. And when it comes to toddlers and infants, it's more like 1 adult and 4 children. And again, one adult.
Okay. So for 3 or 4-year-olds, it's one teacher and perhaps an assistant with 15 children.
Yeah.
How economically feasible is that?
It's expensive.
Does that describe most daycare centers or?
Well, there are ratios that are written into licensing. Uh-huh. Standards, and I'm not sure what they are in Alaska here. I know in Illinois, it's probably between a group between 15 and 20 is uh-huh. probably what you'll find in most places with a teacher and an assistant teacher. Now, the economics of it, you know, require that these people not be paid well if parents are going to find it affordable, uh-huh. which is another issue. That because we require that parents shoulder the burden of the cost of the care and education of children below the age of 5, uh-huh. Then there's a pressure to keep salaries low. and that in turn often provides pressure to keep standards low, experience training for these people low.
Okay, so since you brought that up, let's really state that problem clearly. We as a society have taken upon ourselves as a society, and the government pays most of the bill by allocation of our taxes, the education of our children from age 5
to about 18.
We have not made that decision about from birth to approximately age 5.
Right.
In fact, there's considerable controversy over that issue. There are a number of people who feel that it is not the state's business, that once the state makes it its business, then there will be rules, and there's a fear on the part of some people that that will be the mandatory removal of very young children from the home. Obviously, you probably all participated in this debate. Where do you think we're going on this issue?
I think the workforce, the women are in the workforce is just driving us so that we have to provide care for infants and preschool age children, and whether or not it is a controversial issue, I think that it's just the decision is going to be driven by the fact that women do have to work and the number of single families that there are in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I can share some Alaskan statistics with you on that topic. There are 60% of all women with children under 5 work in Alaska. And a national statistic, the average woman, these are sort of current 1981 or 82 statistics, works 37 years in the workforce, whereas the average man works 43. Now, that's only a discrepancy of 5 years, and that really shows us that women are active and lifelong participants of the workforce outside the home. And out of necessity, but that brings us to a financial problem here, and that is if you work outside the home because it's a financial necessity, you do not, by necessity, you can't afford to have all your income going to daycare,
right?
To child care.
Sure.
What do we do about that?
Well, what often happens is that working women find make-do solutions that are less expensive, using neighbors, using older children sometimes. They're less than ideal solutions. In most urban industrialized societies today, there's some commitment for the early education and care of young children. These are Western societies. These are democratic societies. We have decided not to do that. At least on two occasions, the federal government passed legislation that would have provided support for daycare through the federal government, and in both cases, the laws were vetoed, once by President Nixon, once by President Ford, I believe it was. We haven't had that sort of commitment to the education of very young children that we've had to the education of older children, even college age. You know, where as a parent you pay tuition. The cost of instruction is never covered by tuition at a college or university. So there's at least a sharing mm-hmm. of that sort of responsibility. I understand there's some sort of sharing in daycare responsibility with the state of Alaska.
Yes, we have a daycare assistance program.
Yeah.
And so
there's some of that. And to some extent, I think you should feel good that you're far and beyond what many other states have done in providing this sort of support for parents. Whether it's enough or not, I don't know.
It's not enough, but in fact, we did get some additional monies last year, and this issue is at least being discussed. Whether we've got to the perfect solution or not, of course, is
and whether the money is adequate.
And whether the money is adequate.
Sure.
That still puts us at somewhat of a dilemma in terms of the kinds of salaries that daycare workers, daycare instructors, daycare teachers are paid. And if teachers in our society have a fairly low status, traditionally daycare workers, people who take care of young children, have even lower status.
That's right.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Why do we seem to feel has always struck me as such a great inconsistency from the time of Freud and sort of the birth of modern psychology. We have really attributed great importance to what happens in those first 5 years, and yet we seem to be saying that anybody can take care of young infants.
Sure.
You don't
certify mothers. I mean, that's the argument you often hear.
That, it comes with the genes?
Mothers are constitutionally predisposed to be good caregivers and good educators of young children. Well, the arguments, if you look at the history of this, you go back to the 1830s, and you began to see in the United States some major shifts in the role of women. The idea of the woman's place being in the home is not a natural kind of thing in America. I've always been intrigued if you read the letters between John Adams and Abigail Adams while he was working on all that stuff in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, with the Continental Congresses and the Declaration of Independence and stuff like that. His wife was running the farm and managing it, and she always did. That's the interesting thing. It's not that she just did it because he was away, but she always did it. He rode circuit as a lawyer, and she was the manager. She worked in the field. She managed the cash and everything like that. And essentially in colonial America, you found that women and men were partners in the family across the board, that they both worked. The Puritan male was the father was responsible for the education of the child, not the mother. So you had these kinds of things. But you began to see a shift in about the 1830s where women were suddenly put on a pedestal, that they were revered, that the woman was supposed to be the source of culture and of morality in the home, and she was supposed to protect the child by educating him at her lap at the hearth while the father was out in the cold, cruel world.
But even so, in 1830, this frailty, this helplessness, this wasp-waisted image of women was really reserved to the upper middle class.
Sure.
And
sure. Meanwhile, a lot of women were working in factories, and their kids were being kept by whoever could keep them.
Didn't have child labor laws at that
sure.
time, so many of those children at an extremely young age were putting in very long hours themselves.
True. And you didn't worry about their growing up, because some of them just died before they hit 12 or 14 years of age. Mm-hmm. They would work 12, 14 hours a day in the factory. And it was with the creation of child labor laws, you began to see the creation of childhood and the need to provide for education for the children, because they were going to survive and hopefully thrive later on. But it really goes back to those Jacksonian days when you began to see the shift in the role, not only the role of women, but also the notion that the proper place to educate children were in the home. Before that, children up until 1847, children 3, 4, and 5 were in the public schools of Massachusetts. Nobody thought anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 12% of the children enrolled in 1825 or so were below the age of five. It was 3s and 4s and 5. So we really began to separate out younger children from older children about that time, and also redefine really womanhood and motherhood. And even though it didn't reflect reality, it was the ideal mm-hmm. that ministers and educators and such upheld. And it was that ideal that I think that sort of kept early childhood education from being legitimized if early childhood education was seen as separating the child from the home and the mother.
So it really started with educators theorists.
Well, not with educators and theorists, probably with ministers.
Ministers, mm-hmm. Okay.
And then was later codified
into law.
Yeah.
And then really taken into our sort of emotional expectations.
Yeah.
As time went on.
Yeah, and it was these arguments that, when you read the messages with the vetoes that I mentioned earlier of daycare labor, it was the same arguments that you heard 100 years and 150 years later about the role of women. Again, so that we still have this image of keeping the woman in a gilded cage and protecting
mm-hmm.
her,
mm-hmm.
and protecting her partly because she's the only one that's able to care for these children and nurture these children and educate them until they're strong enough and sturdy enough to deal with the cold, cruel world,
mm-hmm.
be it ever so humble.
And whether we accept that as an ideal situation, I certainly think that many, many mothers really do enjoy staying home with their children at that
sure.
really
And by the way, some fathers do as well.
And a growing number of fathers do as well. And maybe a lot of fathers always felt that way. It's just they weren't allowed that privilege. And certainly it is an exciting time to watch a child change. They really, with my friend's children, I can see that if I'm away for a month or 6 weeks and don't see a child, you can see a notable difference in their vocabulary and their perceptions, their development of their humor, and so on. But again, I guess from your message, I want to say that this is really prescriptive, this idea of when children should be allowed to be out of the home in a learning group learning situation, and when is the best time for them to be at their mother's knee. And certainly it's a privilege, not the rule anymore. Most women who just simply do not have that choice to take that amount of time off their career. Okay, now that brings us to the basic subject, which is all of your professional fields, and that is early childhood education and what's important about it and how we should develop it as a society. First of all, as outside visitors, as visitors from outside, what did you learn from all the teachers, early childhood educators that you talked to here in Alaska? What did they say to you?
The greatest message I think I got was their enthusiasm for continuing to learn and to grow and their dedication to, you know, working with young children and their families. And I think that was stated very clearly with the number of people that attended the conference and that they stayed enthusiastically for all of the sessions, and no one walked out, and they wanted more. And I think it's very important, because I think that that teachers, as any professionals, need to be continually trained and retrained and fed things so that they can grow professionally.
All of us get stale if we don't have a little...
Important enough to even have an early childhood department here, or at least courses at the university level.
Yeah.
So there were over 200 participants, and so obviously there's a real core of people in this state that really care about upgrading their skills and are enthusiastic about their work.
Yeah, there's also a lot of frustration, and that's, frustration in, I think, low status and low salaries for some of them, and this came up with people the number of times that I spoke to. Frustration in the absence of recognition. And the lack of networking abilities, abilities to interact with and meet with people. I think that's why the conference was so important as well.
The isolation, especially that many of the workers have in remote villages, that's geographic, and there isn't very much we can do about that.
But, teachers also have this almost the same kind of isolation when a teacher functions by herself or himself in a classroom without any interaction with other professionals or other adults during the day. So that even though you may see the school as being in an urban place where there's lots of people, from a professional point of view, it might be just as isolated.
Often the interaction of teachers is only about administrative matters and so on, and they have no other opportunity.
Yeah. They're separated from one another.
Maybe they should
the
treat it like a hospital and have rounds, Dr. Rounds.
Sure.
I think that... in order to improve that status, we really have to acknowledge that it's very hard work. Not only is it group work, which means that the person who is supervising has to be aware of all the interactions between the various students amongst each other, but it's also a lot of individual interaction, and anyone who's worked with children knows that they learn at a very different rate, and also they learn in different ways. That some of us are verbally cognitive, and some, and some people are more perceptual, and so on.
And some kids are in a group are older and more mature than others, they can't do the same things. You shouldn't have the same expectations, And so if you take children from one activity to another as a group, and expect each child to perform in that activity the same as every other child. In some of the early childhood programs, you'll find age ranges of at least a year and often 2 years and more. And I think the real need to be sensitive to each child in a classroom, to individualize, to plan for each child in terms of how that child creates meaning, how that child comes to understand the world, how that child performs, is probably the most important thing a teacher can do.
Do you think there's more disparity between... 3-year-old to 4-year-old class than there is, say, later on at 8 or 9 or 10?
Well, the rate of development is so much greater early on. The difference between a toddler, you know, an infant, for example, just a few months makes a difference. But it's the older we get, the more continuity there is from, you know, from time to time. You know, a 3-year-old child, you know, lives 1/3 of his life in that 1 year that he's in the 3-year-old program. It takes us a long time to live 1/3 of our lives in any setting.
Well, that certainly doesn't sound, the way you've just described it, it certainly doesn't sound like work that just anybody can do.
No, I don't think so. I don't think everybody should work with young children as a teacher. But I also think it's more than, it takes more than love of children or childhood. Or just wanting to, you know, being able to enjoy children. There's that. I think you need warmth and understanding and compassion, but you also need training, and you have to know a lot to be able to guide children in their learning and development.
As a professor of early childhood education, what do you do to influence students at the University of Illinois to go into the field? And women.
He writes them letters in Thailand.
There are a couple of things that intrigue me. The university itself, you know, makes a lot of information available to people so that people in high schools can find out about our programs. That's one thing. We find a lot of students, once they get into the university, transferring in and out of programs. So probably half of the people that we graduate as undergraduates really started in some other field and have moved into early childhood education. And in this past year, we started a pre-service master's program, and we found that a lot of people have gotten degrees in something else and have either started work and found out that that's not really what they wanted to do, or for one reason or another changed and wanted to become teachers. And these are some of the most exciting and motivated people that I've met. Some of them, I think interestingly, have been people who might have wanted to be a teacher, and one of them who says to me, I talked to my father, and he says, no, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that's all you could have been. You can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, you can be anything you want to be. And she went into business, and she had a job in public relations for 3 years. And then she finally came back and said to her father, you know, I really want to be a teacher. And she quit her job, you know, within a matter of months, applied to our program, and she's down with us now. I think she's having a ball.
Well, when we describe it, it almost has to be a calling, because when you say, okay, this is going to be a real low-status career, you're going to really be paid very, very little. You are going to have to be on all the time, in the sense that it's very difficult to have a day that you're not really concentrated and with your students, whereas some of us have the privilege of, I do demanding things when I have a lot of energy and sort of some busy work on days when I don't, and that's certainly not an available option for teachers. If you've got 15 4-year-olds around you, your energy must
it's hard.
Be high.
Sure. It's but at the same, you know, it's a calling in some other ways, in that especially amongst early childhood educators, I think you find a high proportion of people who see themselves as serving as advocates for children. Advocates within the classroom, advocates within the local community, advocates in terms of going down to the state capitol and meeting with legislatures and talking to them on behalf of children. The children don't vote. The children don't write letters. The children don't go to legislative hearings. Someone must speak for them. And often it's the teachers of young children who do.
We have a growing children's rights movement. I've been aware of for sort of 10 years. In your years as a professional in the field, do you think that's beginning to change, turning around, that children have rights, that whole concept is getting more
acceptance?
Well,
that's going back. It's taking one step forward and one step back.
It's a pendulum,
I think,
kind of.
That the recent Supreme Court ruling in terms of being able to search, you know, children in school, some of the children's advocates suggest that you've kind of taken a step back, and you get into this business of rights and abilities to cope. That at what point does a child have the same rights and abilities as an adult? When a child is 3 or 4, a child can't sign off for himself or herself in terms of, you know, what's necessary, what's important. so the rights are vested in parents. To some extent, those same rights are vested in, at least temporarily, amongst teachers, but with real limits and real restraints. And I think that's important. But some of the rights that we talk about civil rights, but the right to survive, the right to a decent childhood, the right to a good education, you know, the right to health and nutrition, these are rights that often we don't think a lot about in terms of kids, and yet they're important.
Well, I think they're important from another perspective, and that is we have more and more studies of the criminal population that is. The criminal population that's incarcerated, that's the only criminal population we have ready access to, that is fairly supportive, that a fairly high percentage of those people who have had some criminal activity in their lives have had some really serious deprivations as children, if not absolute abuse. And so as a member of society, I'd like to see that we do a good job with our children so we have more law-abiding citizens as adults who are interested in my rights to life and limb and property and so on. That's fairly idealistic. I don't know that we're going to get to any time when every...
Sure. Yeah, well, even some of the studies in early childhood show that in terms of the cost to society, dollars and cents, money spent on early childhood programs saves money that might otherwise have been spent, you know, and there are multiple, you know, much more money would have to be spent in terms of services to people on welfare, criminal courts, and the like. Yeah.
But it's hard to demonstrate really the payoff of quality and the payoff of content.
Well, they've been doing this, and they've done some actual, you know, cost benefit analyses that are coming through now.
What was your main message to the teachers and to some of the parents that attended this conference? If you have a message to say, what are the things that are most important to you about...
Well, I think before Dr. Spodek said that the most important factor in a quality program is quality, the provider. And I think that what we talked about mostly was the Child Development Associate program as being one way to develop quality child care providers. And that program developed way back in the 60s, too, when there was a great need for competent and more child care providers. And it is a credential that's awarded to people who can demonstrate through their work with young children and their families that they are competent and there are standards that are national standards that they have to demonstrate that they can perform before a parent and to other child care professionals.
Okay, so it's a sort of a demonstration that you have these competencies and then you're evaluated and you're awarded this.
It's a training and assessment process.
What specifically are some of the areas of the training? What specifically are some of the things that the program teaches an early childhood educator?
Well, it starts from teaching just the basic safe and healthy and learning environment to establish those for young children. It goes on to the basic cognitive and social interactions that are necessary for young children, and it basically ends with staff development and becoming a professional.
But specifically, learning through games or...
That's kind of a difficult thing. Help me out, Diane.
What were some of the workshops?
I'm a CDA rep, and so I would go in after an advisor has been working with this candidate for maybe a year, and we'd have this meeting, and first I'd do observation, and just through all these three different functions.
I think that's...
For the benefit of our audience, what were some of the workshops? What was some of the contents, title?
Was it the conference?
Oh, the conference,
Well, wasn't that to try and help train?
Well, all the workshops that we did, we tried to fit them in all the functional areas.
Okay. So that's what I want to know. What were some of those functional areas?
They did on discipline. I did one on nice storytelling.
Health and nutrition.
Health and nutrition.
Cognitive development, math games.
Montessori was
discussed. There was some
discussed.
Stuff on Montessori. So it was a whole range, about the whole gamut of programs for children was somehow addressed in one session or another. And no one person could go to any, to all of the sessions. So you had to choose.
Okay, because some of us don't have young children, and because some of us may have young children, but we drop them off at the daycare center and have to be at work at 8 o'clock. What is the theory presently about the kinds of components that a good program for a 3-4-year-old should contain? What should a good day be for a child of that age? Average.
Well, you're talking about one that should be complex. Be a lot of things go on. And probably the most important thing is that it be balanced.
Sort of Sesame Street theory? No?
No, not really. Well, for one thing, you want kids to be engaged. That is, they need to be actively involved in the process of doing things and learning things. So just, you know, one of the problems with the Sesame Street is that too often children are not engaged. That is, they'll watch it with greater or lesser degree of interest.
Okay. So you want them to be participating.
But it doesn't ask them to do anything. Right.
You want them to be participating.
You want them to be active. You want them to be participating.
And
you want them to express themselves.
You want them to be challenging.
You also want them to be part of a group, to interact with other children, to learn the give and take of living in a group. You want them to be able to move, to develop motor skills, so that either indoors or outdoors, large motor, small motor skills. You want to work on language so that kids learn to speak and develop the beginnings of literacy training. You want them to learn to express themselves with art materials, with craft materials, with music, and with their
words.
Own bodies, movement, as well as words.
This doesn't sound like seen and not heard.
No. It's very busy, and if you go into a good center, there's noise, but it's not noisy noise. You know, there's active noise, and kids are involved, and kids are doing things, and they're trying things out, and they're testing ideas. And sometimes they're sitting and watching. Sometimes they're hearing a story. Sometimes they're listening to somebody talk to them or show them something. So, there are quiet times, and there are more active times. There's some time when the kids are outside, and I'm very impressed with the fact that in Alaska here, children will go out in temperature and weather that we would never allow our children in Illinois.
It really is all relative, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's a cold weather day here is not at all what it is in Illinois.
Should the teachers, simply accept the fact that it takes a half hour to dress a child, to go out and they go out for 5 minutes and then a half hour to undress a child. And the kind of separation you have of indoors and outdoors.
They're a lot faster here.
Yeah.
they can do it real fast.
You're right, it is a problem. I had a friend who had a couple of preschool kids, and she said it was constantly a hassle. By the time she'd get one of them dressed, she needed to put them in the in the Arctic entryway so that they wouldn't overheat by the time she got the next one dressed. And I think if you had three, it would be even more difficult.
These transitions take time, but it doesn't stop them from going outside. And using the outdoors, whatever, which is different than what we do. They do things differently. They do different things just this time of year. And because it's important for children to have fresh air, these teachers are willing to, to really take all the time and do all the things. And the kids learn. Mm-hmm. The kids learn to care for themselves very nicely.
Well, this is the environment they live in, so it's important that they do and not be put off by the dark and the cold.
Right.
Definitely that. And so you also really described a lot of toys that probably don't have a right and a wrong.
Yeah.
They have a number of things that the children could learn to do.
A lot of what we call open-ended materials, that they are open, that kids can use in a variety of ways and create from, that there is no one right answer for these. There's a lot of problem-solving that goes on, a lot of exploring and inquiring and trying to make and create different kinds of things.
As you describe it, a really good daycare could be a really positive thing. Not all of us have, we were talking about motherhood and whether it's genetically encoded, good motherhood is genetically encoded or not before. But I don't think all of us are equally suited to stimulating
children. No, good teaching is not genetically encoded. I think, there's a certain predisposition, there are certain characteristics. You want a teacher who's warm, you want a teacher who has a high degree of energy, you want a teacher who has a commitment to working with children. But what a teacher does requires training, it requires skill, it requires knowledge if it's done well. And one of the concerns I think all of us here have is that often the necessity for this training and knowledge and skill and understanding isn't recognized in the general community, that we've all hired babysitters when our kids were young and the kids have been safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that why can't we simply have kids with babysitters as a model for daycare?
Well, it's one thing if that child is with a babysitter for a few hours when you're out at a movie or at a friend's house for dinner, but it's another thing when you're talking 40 hours a week ongoing and for four or five years.
Yeah, and so what you want to do.
It bothers me to see a sign by daycare centers like for hire and that anyone can walk off, come in from the street and sign up.
But it seems obvious to me, unless we value it as a society and are willing to do something about the real economic problems that are involved with paying for it, that's going to remain the situation. And really what is very clear to me from everything that you've said here is that it's a really complex job, which really does require some very specialized training, some ongoing training, as you've pointed out, and some real special skills and talents. Certainly, I'd have to take myself out of the category. I simply don't think I have the patience for it. It really requires a lot of patience.
Yeah. Well, I thought I was fortunate to meet, for example, with people from TVCC, the community college here, and there's a real interest and concern. They have an early childhood program, and they're interested in making it the best possible one that they can have within this area. And I think that's important. I think it's the recognition from these kinds of institutions that will provide the support for the preparation of people and ultimately the professionalization of the field of early childhood education, here at least.
Well, perhaps as we emotionally as well as intellectually acknowledge that women are part of the workforce and that parenting is a job for both those that father and those that mother, maybe we will sort of incorporate it in the way we make the laws and sort of institutions that we evolve. Do you sense it's more accepted now than it was, say, 20 years ago?
I think so. Probably in the last 10 years, you've seen a much greater acceptance of daycare simply because many more families are availing themselves of it. I think the next step, first step was really to provide the care for children, just services.
Good, safe care, yeah.
Well,
right.
And I think the more and more people now are concerned with looking at the nature of the quality of that care, that it become a high-quality experience for children. And as I go around in various places, I see more and more concern, both from early childhood professionals, but also other people in the community, that are beginning to articulate a need to look at quality and look at ways in which we can assure that children placed in a daycare center or preschool will be placed in a high-quality daycare center or high-quality preschool.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I remember arguments being waged about school taxes not benefiting everybody, but I think we really have to acknowledge that they do benefit all of us because the kind of education and the kind of self-esteem and the kind of feeling that our children have about themselves, whether they're our individual children or not, really is going to affect our society.
Sure.
I'm very concerned about who's going to be pushing my wheelchair around in another 40 years.
They're also the children of our community, for one thing, and to be members of a community, you just don't look out for your own selfish interests. You look out for the shared interests of many. We also need, I think, to be concerned with not only our generation, but the generation that we leave behind us at some point.
I think Fairbanks in general, I have the impression that it does a fairly good job. People who are away from Fairbanks for a while and have their children in other school systems find that they compare very favorably and that they do well. They're not behind. In fact, in some instances, ahead. And maybe part of that is because we're a small, isolated community and people are fairly involved, but it's clear that we need to do more work on it, and especially to get actively involved in this whole discussion about early childhood development. It's clear that it's something that needs all of our participation. You have any final thoughts, things that I didn't cover? I sort of rambled to my own interest, but no? William, Diane?
I think the last point that you made is an important one, and that is the importance of the community, that there is a sense of isolation that people in Fairbanks, I think, have. There are negative elements of that, but I think there are also positive elements of that, and that is the kind of caring for one another and support for one another you can find here. And maybe there's the beginning in this weekend's conference of people looking at what's happening to children and looking at ways in which we can improve what happens to children within Fairbanks.
Yeah, I would definitely like to thank the community. I never saw anything like it. From all different, our advisory council, and Patty was on it, that they just worked and they wanted it to be a success.
Well, this is obviously something that not only one part of society can solve. It's going to require an active dialogue between parents and between teachers, the school system, the government, and people who aren't parents. I thank you very much for joining me, Lillian Sugarman, Bernard Spodek, Diane Suskin. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of Home Fires Radio Show. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella. Have a very nice weekend.